Business leaders, pundits, and politicians all seem to agree. America needs to get much better at nurturing innovation if we are to rebuild our economy, expand opportunity, and win a secure future for our children. But what exactly is innovation? And more importantly, how can parents and educators develop it in our young people? What can we learn from young adults of the millennial generation who themselves are highly successful innovators and entrepreneurs? And what does all of this imply for education policy? To answer these questions and more, Tony Wagner, the author of The Global Achievement Gap and the first Innovation Education Fellow at the Technology and Entrepreneurship Center at Harvard University, interviewed more than 150 people. The result is his acclaimed and commercially successful recent book, Creating Innovators, The Makings of Young People Who Will Change the World. In today's edition of the Education Next Book Club, we speak with Tony about his book, Innovation, and how schools across the world can help to light the spark of innovation within their students. Tony, welcome to the show.
My pleasure, Mike. Good to be with you.
You know, Tony, you are a rare creature, someone who writes about education, who has also managed to sell a lot of books.
Well, sometimes it's just the luck of timing.
Yeah, as a new author, I have come to appreciate just how hard that is to pull off. But tell me, so sometimes it's luck, but clearly this book has struck a nerve. Why do you think there's been such a strong response to this book?
I think more and more people are beginning to understand that our economy has become far too dependent upon consumer spending, which is more than 70% of our GDP. And at the same time, people are truly concerned that that consumer spending has been increasingly over the last decade or so fueled by debt. And I'm not talking government debt now, I'm talking consumer debt. And so I think economists are beginning to ask the question, how do we reduce our dependency on consumer spending as such a driver of our economy? And at the same time, we see multinational companies more and more dependent upon not just incremental improvements, but all kinds of innovations to remain competitive. So I think those two forces have now converged to make innovation kind of really one of the premier issues of our time.
So you start by looking at a young innovator named Kirk Phelps. Tell us about him and particularly what he taught you about parenting innovators.
Well, Kirk is a fascinating guy. He grows up in the Silicon Valley. His parents are really clear that what they want to do is give him all kinds of opportunities to play, more discovery-based play, get outside. And his mother told me one point, she said, you know, sometimes kids have to get bored before they can learn to get unbored. So they limited screen time, fewer toys, toys without batteries. So as he's growing up, he becomes totally intrigued with science as a middle school kid. That's his total passion. His parents are thinking, now, how do we support this interest? They hear that Phillips Exeter Academy is the best school in the country for science, you know, very prestigious boarding school. They get him in. By the middle of 11th grade, he's fed up. First of all, he doesn't think he's getting a particularly good science education, despite the Harkness tables. And secondly, they're not letting him take a course he wanted to take in his free time. So he decides to drop out. Now, you know, parenting dilemma 101. Your kid wants to drop out of Phillips Exeter. Phillips Exeter is saying to you, your kid's life is destroyed. He'll never get into college. What do you do? They supported him. They trusted his decision. And of course, Phillips Exeter folks were totally wrong. He got into Stanford for a combined BS-MS program. So here's a guy going through freshman year of science and decides science is too lonely. He gravitates to computer science, but then he begins to realize he wants to make stuff. He suddenly takes the sequence of courses taught by Ed Carrier called Smart Product Design, combining electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, and computer science. Interdisciplinary, all project-based, all teams-based, all hands-on, Kirk catches fire. He is so excited. He becomes a teaching fellow at some point after the sequence of courses. 2 credits shy of both degrees, which are concurrent from Stanford, Kirk drops out again. Now what do you say as a parent, right? Well, why does he drop out this time? Because he's been drafted by Apple to be the product manager for the very first iPhone. He has an incredibly successful career at Apple, learns all kinds of things about project management, and now he's a senior executive at a startup company called Sunrun, which is devising new ways of selling and installing solar panels on residences around the country.
And so this all starts with his parents being willing to let him be bored, play outside, climb trees. In some ways, you write that this is very much opposite of what we read about a few years ago in the battle hymn of the Tiger Mother.
Well, exactly right.
We should do the helicopter parenting. We should structure our kids' lives. We should push all the time.
Well, a couple of things I really discovered about these young innovators. First of all, they're far, far more intrinsically motivated, less interested in making money than in making a difference. And then when I looked at what both parents and teachers had done to reinforce and stimulate this intrinsic motivation that we're born with, I discovered that both parents and teachers had emphasized three things: play, passion, and purpose. Kirk's parents encouraged this more discovery-based play. They encouraged their kids to try stuff and to make mistakes. You know, as parents tell me, you don't learn to ride a bike unless you're ready to fall. And sooner or later, you're going to fall when you take off the training wheels. So you better do it at a younger age when you kind of heal more quickly.
That's right.
So these parents, I think, are encouraging their kids to take risks within boundaries. They're not trying to hover and protect their parents and plan their every minute of the day and to sort of insulate them from failure or from any kind of adversity or setbacks. They're recognizing that that's a part of what you need to experience in order to learn perseverance, or the things we're calling grit now.
And you say that many of these innovators you came across, and some of the famous ones out there, they many of them went to Montessori preschools.
Well, that wasn't my discovery. I in doing the background research on innovation, I discovered a study came out of Clay Christensen's group at the Harvard Business School, and it was called The Innovator's DNA. It's now become a book. And in their reviews and interviews with some of the most successful innovators and entrepreneurs, the guys who started Google, Jeff Bezos at Amazon, Jimmy Wales at Wikipedia, they made the rather stunning discovery that large numbers of these people had gone to Montessori schools. And not only that, they credited the Montessori independent, self-motivated learning experience mm-hmm. with having developed their capabilities to innovate and to be entrepreneurial.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. You know, some listeners know that I consider myself a koala dad, and that I've had my son at a Waldorf preschool.
Oh, is that right?
Which he's even loopier than Montessori, but also into this.
Yeah, but you know, there's a lot of good models out there. I think Reggio Emilio is another one. So it's fascinating to see this.
All right. So you spend a chapter writing about a handful of STEM innovators, young people that are doing amazing things in the field of science, technology, engineering, and math. Tell us about one of them.
Well, Kirk was certainly one, but you know, David Senge also comes to mind. Native Sierra Leone, he goes to United World College for kind of post high school year, and he starts his first NGO, and he figures out a way to distribute malaria nets in his home country of Sierra Leone with a much, much higher acceptance rate than anything the UN had been able to do. He's 16, 17 years old. He comes to Harvard because he's told it's the place to come for innovation. He contacts this fellow by the name of Paul Bottino, who runs the Technology and Entrepreneurship Center at Harvard. And so he goes through 4 years of Harvard, and he becomes involved with this lab where he and several of his colleagues in the lab as a part of work study start developing the use of microbes in dirt to generate electricity. Goes on to win a very large prize and starts his second NGO. In 2010. He graduates in 2010, and I interview him 5 days before his commencement. And so he talks for 2.5 hours about all of this work that he's done and all that he's learned and all that he wants to do. I said, David, you haven't said one word about Harvard classes in 2.5 hours. He said, frankly, that's because I didn't learn anything in any of my classes. Then he corrects himself. He says, except for Spanish. I did learn to speak Spanish. But he said, in all the other classes, everything else I learned that I valued was outside of the classroom. Then he talks about his future education plans. He only applied to one graduate school, the MIT Media Lab. I said, why? He said, 3 reasons. No grades, no required classes, and I get to build things that people need, which, of course, is where David is now. So I think in David's story, as well as in Kirk's story, we see a lot of sort of counterintuitive findings where, in fact, for many of these young innovators, both in STEM fields and in non-STEM fields, some of whom went to very prestigious schools, they did not become innovative because of their schooling. They became innovative more often in spite of their schooling. And so that has led me to sort of question the priorities of many of our Research One universities, and in fact, whether they are the engines of innovation that we we've assumed they are and that I assumed they were when I started the study.
All right. Well, yeah, let's stop there for a moment, get a little bit wonky here on policy implications. You are critical then of the country's focus on getting more students into STEM courses. This is a priority for Bill Gates and his foundation, for example. Why don't you think that is necessarily the way to go?
Well, I don't think it's more of the same science and math courses that are going to produce innovators. I think we need, certainly we need more people to be engaged in STEM activities. But here's a stunning statistic, Michael, that I learned from Rick Miller, who's president of the brand new Olin College of Engineering. Stunning numbers. What is the four-year completion rate of public schools of engineering? 22%. What is the four-year completion rate of private schools of engineering? 46%. Olin's 98%. What's the difference? Olin has turned all the assumptions about engineering education upside down. All of the work is project-based. All of it is interdisciplinary. It's hands-on. It's team-based. The teams of the Olin seniors spend an entire senior year working in a corporation on a real problem. They design their own majors at Olin, more than half the kids. So what I deeply believe is that we need a radically different approach to STEM education. If we're going to really engage our kids in wanting to become the innovators that we need them to be, and more of the same education is not going to get us there. And I don't see policymakers or business leaders understanding that important distinction.
So you just mentioned at the higher education level, what about for elementary schools and high schools?
You know, I have to say, I think the way most science and math courses are taught are boring. And I worry that, frankly, Common Core is not going to be enough of a solution. By contrast, again, you go to High Tech High in San Diego, where more than half the science and math courses are taught interdisciplinarily. They're taught in terms of trying to solve real problems. They're taught with hands-on projects. And High Tech High got more kids into Stanford the last time I studied it a few years ago than any other non-legacy high school. And it is predominantly minority, very, very diverse school. And I think they show how, at both the secondary and college level, a different approach to science and math education will get us kids who are far more engaged and more skillful.
All right, but let me push back a little bit. Some people would argue, let's say a Don Hirsch or admirers of his and his Core Knowledge Foundation, this idea of cultural literacy, that already our schools are underemphasizing the importance of knowledge. They don't do a very good job exposing kids to the content they're going to need to eventually become expert in these fields, especially poor kids who are coming into school in many cases with such limited vocabulary and limited knowledge about the world. They're only going to get it in school. I mean, aren't you worried that by prescribing project-based approach or this more constructivist approach, that in some ways you could accidentally make our schools even less focused on knowledge? That could be really bad for lots of kids.
Well, I think this is a really important discussion to have, and it's certainly not skills versus content. And I find Don's arguments around introducing kids at very young ages to a wide variety of kind of literature and knowledge to be a compelling argument. He makes it the point of view that, you know, lots of times these kids are reading books and they're encountering words and concepts they have no understanding of because they've had no content knowledge. That makes some sense to me. However, when I see what kids will need to succeed in the 21st century, I see a three-legged stool that they all must stand on. One is content knowledge, one leg. The second is skills. The world simply no longer cares how much you know. What the world cares about is what you can do with what you know, which is a different education problem. At a time where knowledge is becoming a free commodity, the emphasis is far more on skill. And then finally, the third leg of the stool is motivation. And the student who is self-motivated, who has a hunger to learn, who's really curious, will continuously acquire new skills and new content knowledge as needed. Because the content knowledge, Mike, is changing. It's growing exponentially, especially in the STEM fields. So you can't assume that the content knowledge you acquired in middle school or high school is going to serve you well 6 years later. And besides that, my experience is, and I, as you may know, taught for more than 17 years at high school and college level, if kids don't have a reason to learn something, they won't retain it. And so, yes, content knowledge is important, but how you learn it, when you learn it, and for what reason you learn it matter enormously in terms of retention.
Okay. We'll come back to some of this in a moment. You write that, of course, not all innovators want to go work for Apple or for Google. Some want to make the world a better place via social entrepreneurship. So tell us about one of the social innovators that you feature. Again, some fantastic young people.
They're equally interesting. They're equally motivated, equally talented. But I think they're probably a little less oriented to the science and math side of things and more interested in the humanities. Laura White comes to mind. She's volunteering at a summer camp. She's 15 years old. She's a competitive swimmer. And a bunch of kids just start racing into the water. These are kids, disadvantaged kids from the city, from Atlanta, where she lived. Suddenly, bunches of them start drowning because they don't know how to swim. So she rescues, I think, five or six of these kids and realizes that something has to be done to teach these kids. So she starts her own nonprofit, gets some support from Ashoka, and starts figuring out how to teach young kids how to swim. She figures out how to put these programs on college campuses. She figures out how to recruit older students to help, who then go get their life-saving certificates. Incredibly successful. And so her next step is to go find a school that takes service seriously. So she ends up going to Tulane, which has, under the leadership of Scott McCowan, has really started trying to take the whole idea of service to the community and service learning very, very seriously. And so she blossoms there, but again, not because of the formal curriculum, but because she has an extraordinary mentor, John Howard, not tenured, like our friend Ed Carrier at Stanford, not tenured, not going to be tenured. I mean, one of my core findings is that the teachers have made the greatest difference with these young people are outlier teachers, none of whom are tenured. Mm. But nevertheless, she blossoms, and now she's out working for Ashoka, as a matter of fact, but wanting to start her own nonprofit and wanting to teach other people how to become innovators.
So in chapter five, you go deep on what this all means for schools. And you say, and you've said some of this already, is that increasingly in the 21st century, what you know is far less important than what you can do with what you know. And so you're not so excited about our current focus on standardized testing and evaluating teachers based on those tests and the like. Explain that.
Well, first of all, let me be really, really clear. I am not one of those folks that just merely bashes current accountability systems. I advocate for accountability 2.0. I deeply believe in accountability. I think we're not going to turn the clock back. I believe it is critically important that we assess teachers. Mm. I don't know what that was. Mm-hmm. I just do not happen to believe that assessing teachers' effectiveness on the basis of a standardized multiple choice factual recall test tells us anything that is in any way useful. So from my point of view, first and foremost, we have to be much more clear about the outcomes that matter most in the 21st century. As I've suggested, I think it is this mix of content knowledge, competencies, and motivation. And then secondly, we have to design an accountability system that is aligned with the outcomes that matter most. And to me, that means using selective use of very, very high quality performance assessments like the College and Work Readiness Assessment, which is a proven, valid, reliable test of analytic reasoning, critical thinking, problem solving, and writing. And if we think of an auditing strategy, we don't have to give this to every single kid. We can then afford it. We can use it as a tool to hold districts accountable. In terms of teacher effectiveness, I want to see teachers assessed on the improvements in their students' work between September and June. I want to see every student have a digital portfolio, another element of accountability 2.0, something that can be very easily done now. A number of schools, in fact, are doing it. And that when we talk about a teacher's effectiveness, it's on the basis of a body of student work, which we then can audit and say, all right, do we see evidence of improvement in student work on the skills that matter most as opposed to their test-taking skills?
So some people would say, look, Tony, this is great, but you're taking this tiny little sample of these incredible young people, many of whom came from prestigious universities and affluent homes, two-parent families, went on to, you know, incredible opportunities, and you're taking this tiny sample and you're applying lessons to everybody else, you know, to a population of kids, 50 million people, few of whom share a lot of those same opportunities that some of your innovators did. And particularly many people in education reform are most focused on the challenge of how do we help kids growing up in poverty and help them get a shot at making it out of poverty as adults. And you mentioned KIPP as one great innovation in the book. So charter schools like KIPP that do this. You know, are you worried that some of the prescriptions that you're pushing could have some negative trade-offs or side effects? Yeah. That in effect, you know, some of these things that work to help a kid go from Exeter to Stanford to Apple, it may be different when you're talking about how to help a kid go from, you know, inner city neighborhood and get a shot at making it through a community college to a middle class job.
Yeah. Well, just as a correction, Mike, precisely because of that concern, I very intentionally also profiled kids who were growing up in disadvantaged circumstances, children of single parents, moms, children growing up in real poverty, and discovered that for those students as well, the opportunity to have a teacher and a mentor who's really encouraging intrinsic motivation, who can help them understand why what they're learning is important, was every bit as valuable as it was for the kids of privilege. So I don't think this is just a recipe or a prescription for middle-class kids going to prestigious schools. Three of the eight kids whom I profiled did not or have not yet completed college, three out of the eight. And yet, all three of them, extraordinarily innovative. And in fact, in my own personal experience, my first 5 years, I taught at-risk kids in an alternative public high school. So I know that population. And it's even more important for that population to have a reason to want to learn, to want to succeed. And merely giving them more tests to pass does not give them a reason or an incentive to excel. And so I actually think for our disadvantaged students, so-called interest-based learning has even a higher priority. That's why I think the MET network of schools under the umbrella of the Big Picture Company may in fact be a more important model than KIPP in terms of how high schools need to develop self-discipline of students, develop students' grit and so on by encouraging their intrinsic motivation and their interest in thinking about a very different kind of future.
I'll say more about that, especially with respect to KIPP. I mean, do you think that the KIPP model then is flawed? I mean, it's got a very big focus on academics, greater focus these days on some of these non-cognitive skills like grit that we're all talking about more now, but very much focused on getting kids into college and ready to compete with middle-class, upper-middle-class kids. You have concerns about that model?
I do. First of all, let me couch it in terms of a real respect for the folks at KIPP. I admire their mission. I admire them as personally. I've gotten to know some of them. I've visited KIPP schools. I've spoken to future KIPP leaders at their request. So this is in the context of being a critical friend. I think they rely far too much on two things. Number one, extrinsic carrots and sticks to incent good behavior and to incent academic achievement. At some point, extrinsic incentives, carrots and sticks, are only going to get you so far. Mm-hmm. And I think at some point, kids who are motivated primarily by carrots and sticks are going to wind down and wind out. By contrast, the MET schools are much more focused on developing and figuring out what is it the students are really interested in. The second concern I have, Mike, goes back to what I learned when I was in Finland. As you know, I spent some time in Finland and made a documentary film with Bob Compton called The Finland Phenomenon. And I discovered that while every kid gets the identical same education through ninth grade in Finland, beginning in 10th grade, they get a choice between an academic track and a career vocational technical track that's been developed in very close collaboration with businesses and leads straight to good paying jobs. Here's the interesting thing, Mike. 45% of the kids choose a technical career vocational track. I was in Douglas County, Colorado, 4 weeks ago, teaching a class to a group of seniors, all of whom from upper middle class families. We were talking about that model. They'd seen the documentary film. And I said, just out of curiosity, these were all seniors, all headed to college, they said, 100%. I said, how many of you would have chosen a technical career vocational track had it been offered near high school? Mike, half the kids in the room put up their hands. If we say all kids college ready is the only option for every kid, and I worry that that's what Common Core is saying to all kids, then I think we're going to destine large numbers of kids to frustration and failure. Not every kid wants to or needs to or can afford to go to college. We need to have meaningful technical career vocational education. And so that plus the motivation issue are my two concerns about KIPP.
And it almost seems like there's some agreement on maybe the elementary school curriculum, something that perhaps you and Don Hirsch could agree upon with a lot of focus on cultural literacy. And maybe even the KIPP model at those younger ages. But then at some point, as kids get into adolescence and teenage years, that the high school model in particular, and then into the college model, you think needs to look a lot different. Tell us about High Tech High. You're big on High Tech High, as am I. What are they doing differently, and how might other high schools model themselves after that?
Well, I think there's so much that they do differently, it's almost hard to know where to start. First of all, teams of teachers have shared responsibility for groups of students over time. So the accountability is reciprocal, relational, and face-to-face. If you're a teacher on that team, other people are going to know if you teach poorly. But beyond that, there's a kind of openness there and a sense of through lesson study and through continuous improvement that it's okay to ask your teammates, for colleagues, for help. You know, I had a team visit there once, and their biggest takeaway was a moment when a teacher rushed late to his team meeting, waving a DVD in his hand, saying, "I just had an advisory last period and I completely blew it. But I videotaped it. Will you look at it with me?" Mm. Now, that's radical. When you have that kind of culture, that's the highest form of accountability, in my opinion. Then you layer on top of that the very different approaches to teaching and learning. Almost all the courses are interdisciplinary. They're project-based, where students in nearly every class are creators, not consumers. They have to produce real products for real audiences. So, for example, to complete ninth grade, teams of students have to create a new product or service and have to figure out what the business model is, what the budget's going to be. They have to write a proposal, and then they have to pitch it to some real entrepreneurs and venture capitalists who've come in to listen to their proposals. And several of them actually have gotten funding. So this whole emphasis on more kind of learning that is situated in the context of real problems, open-ended questions, using multiple disciplines to answer a question or solve a problem, I think is part of the success of High Tech High. But of course, as you know, they have a hard time finding the right teachers, so that's why they started their own graduate school of education. And I think that's the latest and greatest of their innovations, and I look forward to following it.
And how do they deal, though, with the fact that they must have students come into their school who are still struggling with some of those basic skills and the content knowledge that you talked about in terms of the three-legged stool? Do they have to do some intensive work to get kids ready to be able to do this kind of project-based work?
Well, I think that there is a lot of individual attention on kids and an opportunity to individualize learning as kids are discovered to need it. I've seen this in other schools as well, and the same thing in the Finnish public schools, where students are recognized as having a learning difficulty or needing some kind of help. They're given intensive help as soon as that problem is discovered. But having said that, I think a lot of these 9-12 charter schools, grades 9 through 12, really struggle. And they struggle because they're not getting students early enough in the pipeline. I think a 7-12 model invariably is going to be more successful. And as you know, High Tech High now is a network of K-12 schools serving more than 4,000 kids. And for me, that's the real obvious advantage. Very hard when you're starting in ninth grade with kids reading at a third or fourth grade level. Really, really hard.
So at the end of the book, you write a letter to young innovators. What do you tell them?
Oh, my. Well, that letter really came from the heart. I never knew I was going to write it, in fact, until near the end. And it came as much from my own experiences trying in a small way to innovate in education. And it was an attempt to sort of reassure people who want to innovate that sometimes their work is going to be lonely. Lots of times it's going to be frustrating. They're certainly going to fail. And in fact, if they're not failing, they're not edgy enough. They're not taking enough risks, because that's a part of what it means to innovate. But I also tried to suggest that the importance of their persevering and being true to their own vision, true to their own creative spirit and to their own uniqueness. I think the capacity to innovate in some way is a gift. And the question is, can we live up to our own gifts?
Now, I understand that you wrote this book largely for parents and for educators, but I can imagine that many young people are going to find this book to be inspiring and helpful as well, as they hear about other people like themselves who have figured out how to make their way to survive the American school system and then to go on to do great things.
Well, I've gotten a lot of feedback from young people, particularly actually in response to that letter, but more generally as well. It's been very, very gratifying.
All right. Well, once again, this is Tony Wagner, the author of Creating Innovators, The Making of Young People Who Will Change the World. Tony, thanks so much for joining us on the Education Next Book Club.
My great pleasure, Mike. I enjoyed the conversation.
Executive producer of the Education Next Book Club is Marcy Kansterin. Audio engineer is Joe Portnoy. And I'm your host, Mike Petrilli, for the Education Next Book Club.